Glory, His Divine Story, every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Size Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m. Shri Sai Ram. Glory be to our God and our Lord, His Divine Worship Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba, who is our Cosmic Christ, His Son, Jesus the Christ, and all the divine beings and angels and the blessed devotees of Lord Sai who have descended upon the divine valley of Prashanti Nilayam from all over the world right here in south of India to celebrate Christmas 2017. Jai Sai Ram, Feliz Navidad, Merry Christmas, and a very good morning, dear listeners. My name is Karuna, and on behalf of the entire team at Radio Sai, I welcome you warmly to Morning Glory on Thursday Live. We are coming to you live from the Radio Sai studios inside Prashanti Nilayam, the spiritual capital of the universe. Today is the 21st of December 2017, and the time in the ashram right now is 39 minutes past 9 a.m. I deliberately try to start a bit early because I have a fun and inspiration-packed show lined up for you. Now, believe it or not, at the moment, we are at the peak of Prashanti Nilayam's winter. This is the Puttaparthi winter, as cold as it gets here. Currently, we are experiencing what I feel is heavenly weather. Overnight mercury last night dipped to 12 degrees Celsius. Now, that's really cold around here. And daytime highs are close to 30 degrees Celsius. In Fahrenheit, that would be like 55 or 56 Fahrenheit to 86 Fahrenheit range. Clear blue skies and plenty of lovely sunshine. Traffic in downtown Puttaparthi this morning was busy and chaotic. But inside the ashram, it is busy and orderly and pretty silent. That is because we don't use the horn inside the ashram, something that's very common on Indian roads. Right now, as we speak, Prashanti Nilayam is all decked up in the spirit of Christmas, and Baba's devotees of all skin and hair colors are milling around as the various teams put up the decorations, and of course, our choir practices have intensified. The lawns in front of the western canteen and that row of trees is a gorgeous sight to behold, especially at night time. And I promise you, I will keep taking some pictures and posting them on my Facebook page from time to time just to share a glimpse. And I know on our Radio Sai page, you will see a beautiful photo story and an album of all the Christmas decorations happening in the ashram. This is the only place where Kartik Bhagwanji and Ganesha and serpent gods, Mata Saraswati, everybody joyfully celebrates Christmas in the spirit of oneness, as does Jesus the Christ, who is very tall and handsome, I told you, in that special park behind the Golden Ganesha. I hope right now you can feel that love and that true spirit of Christmas flowing to you from Prashanti Nilayam, the abode of the Cosmic Christ, the seat of all that is true, auspicious and beautiful. And today on Morning Glory, I have a Christmas special lined up for you. In the latter half of the show, I will play for you an interview that I had recorded live with the late Joyce Darlene Barker a few years ago. When I invited this fellow Canadian to the studio and told her that it was a live show, she was concerned because she says sometimes she loses track of time. So she asked me to gesture to her when she was supposed to wind up her discussion. So both of us agreed upon two hand signals that I was supposed to give her. One was to wind up within a couple of minutes and the other was to really stop about now because you're going over time. So Joyce, being her sweet self, she diligently rehearsed the signals and their meaning with me. And just then when the show began, my sweet Joyce Darlene simply closed her eyes and in a state of trance she spoke. So that was for the hand signals. And she was in such a trance and clearly her higher self was speaking. And even without opening her eyes once, she kept going at it and stopped exactly when her time was up. Now you know, dear sisters and brothers, what we mean when we say that the boss around Radio Sai is Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba himself, who picks the voices, the words, the timings, the scheduling of our programs, and also the feedback that we get, because that's what we need to hear. But before I play that interview with the late Joyce Darlene Barker, I have a brand new episode of Tryst with Divinity for you as our fresh Christmas offering at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Mrs. Geeta Umesh and her husband, Mr. Umesh Rao, come from a long-standing tradition of Sai Seva. Their bond with the avatar is intergenerational and intense. Dear listeners, this is going to be about 4 episodes long. And Bhagwan has willed for it to be played during this holiday season, this holy season, for a very specific reason, which I need you to trust me with for not divulging yet. So please take a leap of faith and just trust your host. And do not, and the not is in bold and underscore, miss a single episode. I'm going to hand you over to Mrs. Geeta Umesh and Mr. Umesh Rao. This is part one of their Tryst with Divinity interview. And we'll go on with this into the new year. And this will be followed by the interview that I spoke about, because the interview with Joyce Darlene Barker from Canada, the late Joyce, she is now in heaven with Bhagwan. It resonates the true spirit of Christmas. And I think given the time of the year we are at, it is a wonderful idea to hear her. With that, I wish you a awesome, awesome day ahead. And one gentle reminder, I will be eagerly looking forward to your feedback. And yes, thank you for all the feedback to last week's interview with Elizabeth Pilleville. It was wonderful to hear from all of you. And I look forward to hearing from everyone regarding the 2 interviews that I'm going to play today. Our feedback email ID remains listener@radiosai.org. So please, stay happy, stay awesome, stay sisome, and enjoy the rest of this sacred Thursday. And thank you for your company. Stay with us for the entire duration of Thursday, your live wire connection to Prashanthi Nilayam on Radio Sai. Om Shri Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome to Tryst with Divinity. My guests today on the 4th of November 2017 are Mrs. Geeta Umesh and her husband, Mr. Umesh Rao of Bangalore. This is an interview that I have been running in my head for quite some time, for quite a few reasons, which you will enjoy discovering along with me over the next few hours, and I promise you about that. The Raos have had long and meaningful engagement with the Sai mission, and I knew that we would all stand to learn much from their journey with Sai. By way of a brief introduction, let me just say that Mr. Umesh Rao and Mrs. Geeta Umesh have been in the Sai fold since 1963. Mrs. Geeta Umesh holds a master's degree in economics. She is a trained Bharatanatyam dancer and she is quite an aesthete who has dedicated her life to Sai mission in various roles, including as a Bal Vikas guru and a landscaper. Currently, she is the head of the counseling department at the Sri Sathya Sai Institute of Higher Medical Sciences in Whitefield, Bangalore, and her husband, Mr. Umesh Rao, is the senior consultant and mentor in the same department. Apart from his counseling and mentoring, Mr. Rao is also the chair and managing director of Lotus Energy System and an alumnus of the Indian Institute of Science, Bangalore. Geeta ji and Umesh ji, loving Sai Ram to both of you and a very warm welcome to Radio Sai.
Sai Ram.
I can't begin to tell you how good it feels to finally have you with us this afternoon.
It is definitely Swami's divine will that we are here.
Yes, I totally believe that because yes. I think everything in this studio is run by our scheduler, master designer and director. Yes. And that is Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba. I truly believe that.
He picks the date and the time when always. This should happen. Yeah. So.
And I will also share a secret. We just randomly record and in a sequence and edit our interviews and air them as they come up, mm-hmm. one at a time, first recorded, first aired kind of basis. And we have no idea about people's personal dates, which means something to them. But invariably, many things gets aired on the day which is most meaningful to that guest. So this place is run by a different power altogether. And to that power, we bow with so much of love and gratitude. Yes. So I'm going to begin with you, sir, Mr. Umesh Rao. You come from such an illustrious family, and it was in your DNA you were meant to live a life of serving because of your father, Dr. Sundar Rao, who was so dedicated, a medical professional who was an ophthalmologist, who was already dedicated to serving. So coming to Swami seemed like a natural progression.
Yes, very much so, because my father was always spiritually minded. Spiritual, true in the sense that it was a combination of being drawn to the cosmic consciousness, if you want to take that as a definition of spirituality, and a commitment to work and to service. Combination of this was what was in his DNA, which I think he passed on. But what really drew us to Swami per se was something that happened in our lives in the year 1963.
And you were a young man in your 20s?
I was in the US at that time.
I see.
And perhaps it's a sense of regret that I was not there during that period of 63 to 68, because it was in the end of 68 that I returned to India from the US. And that's when I first saw Swami, although I heard about him from 63 onwards, that my family had been.
So what happened in 1963?
So that is what I'd like Geeta to narrate, because she was involved with Swami and how we came to Swami right from the year 63.
You were a little girl then.
I was 13 years old, and my husband and I are related. We are second cousins.
I see.
So we all come from the same family.
Ah, that's where the good books come from.
So it all started with my nephew, Gautam. He was about 4 years old at that period, and he was the son of Professor Narendra and Ushaka. Ushaka was my husband's sister, and he just received a note from school saying that suddenly he'd lost some amount of his vision. And the parents didn't take it very seriously at that point, because both Professor Narendra and his wife Ushaka were myopic, you know, they were wearing glasses. So they thought maybe my child has developed it at a very young age. And Ushaka's father, that is my father-in-law, Dr. M.B. Sundar Rao, was a very well-known, well-renowned eye surgeon. So as parents, they said, we are going to Bangalore in any case during the vacation, so we'll just take the child there and have him checked. That's where it ended at that point. And gradually, we just started losing his sight, but never complained even once that he couldn't see. So by the time they brought him to my father-in-law was really shocked.
He was the grandfather of the
child. Yes, he was the first grandchild of the family. And such a beautiful baby with large eyes and flawless skin and so talkative, so intelligent. So my father-in-law realized it just didn't have to do with the eyes, but it had something to do more with his central nervous system. And so his very close friend was Dr. Verma. So he took the child there. And at that period, neuroscience was at a very infant stage. We are talking about 63. And various tests were performed, which were very painful. But ultimately, Dr. Verma mentioned that, I don't think there's a cure for this illness. And around the same period as when my husband was in the US, he was in Minneapolis then, very close to Mayo. So he said, send the reports and we'll have it all checked out here. But then even from there, the reply was medical field had closed all its doors for this particular problem. And they diagnosed it as demyelination of the central nervous system. So they said, well, right now the defect is only with the sight, but we never know which way this is going to turn. And the doctors just gave my nephew 6 months' time.
Oh, how sad.
Yeah, that's where we were. And, you know, when all doors and windows are shut from medicine, we were a very spiritual as well as a religious-minded family. So we just started praying very hard for our nephew, Gautam. And a far relative of ours came and mentioned this to my in-laws as well as to Viju's paternal grandparents.
Gautam.
Swami named him Vijay Sai later on, so we can call him Viju.
Okay.
Because he said, Gautam, let it end now. I'm going to name you Vijay Sai, the victorious one. And by that, Swami meant this would be his last birth. No more birth for Vijay. But we took it as he's going to be cured at that point. But of course, time went by and we got to know about Baba through a very far off relative of ours. She said, here is this Baba from Andhra Puttaparthi and we've seen miracles happen by him. He's made lame people walk and given vision to people. So at that point, you just grasp at anything which is offered. And as I said, we do come from a religious, spiritual minded family. Some of the elders who did not want to get into any of these miracles, and so they were a little hesitant coming from the scientific field. But when there is no hope, you just try to see, okay, where else can we go for? And that's how the first visit was by Professor Narendra Usharaka, his wife, and his parents in Chennai. Swami was visiting Sri Ishwar's house, and that's where the whole place was so jam-packed with people. And they were living in Adayar at that point, Gandhinagar. So the little nephew was taken there. And Professor Narendra has written a very beautiful article. Because of the crowd, he couldn't see Baba. The only thing which he could see was the faces of the people who were seeing Baba.
Mm-hmm.
And he says it looked as though the sun had just risen.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at the face of the devotees, because suddenly there was light on everyone's face. At that point, he said, this must be definitely a divine source.
Mm-hmm.
And then he turned around, he got a glimpse of Swami. And fortunately for the family, Swami called them all in for the interview. They went in a very sad state of mind, but only a miracle happened inside that interview room, because every member of the family walked out of that interview room with a smile on their face. The problem was still there, but there was something so spontaneous, the unconditional love of Swami, which touched every member of the family. And they came out with a beaming smile, with hope. And ever since, not a single day has passed where the family ever lost hope. They were always so hopeful. And Swami kept hope alive. And that's the first lesson I learned as a child of 13. And that's what we have actually integrated into counseling the Sai way.
So what did Swami tell them about the child?
I think he said not to worry, that they have come at the right time and he would take care, complete care of Gautam. I mean, at that point he was called Gautam. And he reassured every member of the family that a new journey had just then begun. And truly it was so. Because Professor Narendra's father was the president of the Lions Club, so the social circle was very vast. And my father-in-law was the president of the Rotary Club in Bangalore. So he again had a very large group of friends. 50% of the time used to go away in basically interacting towards something good, towards a social cause, no doubt. And the remaining 50, of course, towards the profession to which they were committed to. And they were very well known in their circles. But the moment Swami touched our lives, I think there was definitely a transformation.
And for how much longer did Vijay Sai live after that?
Well, the doctors had given him only 6 months,
right.
But he lived to be 16.
Oh.
And that was a journey which was full of hope, surrender. These are the lessons we learned because of Vijay Sai. And finally, Swami said, he is your guru because he brought the entire family to me.
That soul came
yes.
into the family to draw you all to him.
Absolutely. And Swami also said he's taken birth so that he will never have another rebirth. And Swami did not give any false hopes or false promises at that point. But at every point, whatever was needed was what Swami gave. You know, at that point, they needed this reassurance that he would live longer than 6 months and that things can brighten up. Though physically, Vijay Sai's health started deteriorating, I think the entire family's focus, the center of everyone's focus, was the love which we received from Swami and the love which Viju received from Swami. Because no matter where Vijay Sai was, Swami would come walking all the way, talk to him. And at every point, he would give us hope by giving a little bit of vibhuti, a tender smile. And his blessings was constant on the entire family, but more so on Vijay Sai. I think this kind of focused attention which we received from divinity, our family was truly blessed. And the cause of it was Vijay Sai.
Was accepting his passing on heart?
Well, actually, I think by then the entire family was so dedicated towards service to Swami, and Professor Narendra actually was already the principal of Baba's college.
At Whitefield.
At Whitefield, Brindavan. And his passing away was, of course, around the period of 1974. Swami had left for Bombay, and when Swami returned from Bombay on March 9th, 1974, Mama was busy at college, and when he returned home, he realized that Vijay Sai's temperature had gone up has gone up to almost 105 degrees. A doctor was sent, and the next day he developed some amount of rigors and he became unconscious. And the third day, on 11th, is when he passed on. The Baba was in Puttaparthi. He said, we should bring Vijay Sai to Puttaparthi and have him cremated at the Chitravati. So the cremation happened there, and after we returned, after Narendra Mama returned back, he went back straight to college. Immediately he rejoined duty, because the pre-university board exam was on. There's no way in which he could slip up. And that's something which I learned from him. That's a kind of dedication also which the family had towards anything which was given to them as seva or work by Swami. And Swami, immediately the very next day, he visited our home. And I think having Swami in our lives made things so easy for us to accept. He came home and he said, you should be distributing sweets. You should rejoice today because Vijay Sai has come to me. He's attained moksha.
Changes your perspective completely, doesn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely. And very beautifully Swami explained the whole thing. He said, this child has had just remnants of karma which he had to complete.
Clear.
Yeah, clear in this birth. So such souls select the parents, select the timing, and they're born to parents who will keep them close to God. And He has brought you close to God. So He is actually your guru. So there's no point in weeping over this. These were Swami's words given around that period to us. And it made us perceive things so differently, because we did see His physical body deteriorating gradually, because not only did He lose His sight, except for His hearing, He had lost every other faculty. And Swami said, see, he only had one faculty, that of hearing, and that's all that you need to become one with God. That was another great learning for us, because people would come to us to kind of console the parents, but the moment they entered the room where my nephew was, where Vijay Sai was, there was some amount of energy emanating from the child which would heal them, and they would leave with a smile on their face. This was the kind of gift Swami bestowed on us. And I think we all took it as a great blessing that we could be of some service to a child like that. Viju passed away at 74. He had the younger brother Bharat, and Vidulata was his sister. So he just loved them. And the moment we would go to him and read stories to him, he would respond. It wasn't as though he wasn't cognitive of what was going on. You know, he was conscious of all that which was being said. He would laugh at jokes. And the most important thing was, he loved bhajans. So our day would start with the Omkar, the Suprabhadam, which, you know, even if not for our sake, we would play it for Viju's sake. Because he was very, very keen on all of that, and bhajans every evening. And the moment he heard from people that Baba has come to Vrindavan, he would just laugh.
Out of joy.
Out of joy. And then that would mean morning and evening, driving him to Whitefield for darshan, and Swami coming and talking to him. Morning and evening, Swami would come and talk to him.
Very dramatic entry into the Sai fold.
It is, yes.
But appears like it had a very positive impact on the whole extended
family. Absolutely, yes.
I think Swami took care of the trauma part of it, because they normally say, you know, when there is a traumatic event in one's life, the loving grace and compassionate hold of someone kind of makes that trauma less hurtful.
For sure. It's the anesthesia.
Yes. And that's how Swami kept us throughout. And it's not that we didn't face challenges, other type of challenges in life. He kept testing whether we surrendered to him completely or not. But definitely, I think the spirit of surrender was something which got ignited at every stage, at every challenge.
I see. And sir, what about yourself? You were witnessing all this happening to your sister's son.
Yes. Sitting about half the world away.
Yeah,
in the US,
but you were in touch, and you had contacted the Mayo Clinic.
Yes, but staying in touch in those days was not as easy.
I know. No WhatsApp, no email.
Yes. No email, nothing. So we had to correspond only by mail, regular post, and maybe an occasional call, because then it was an act of God that, you know,
The trunk call went
trunk
through.
Call and all kinds of lightning calls and so on. But nevertheless, you know, and once in 67, Damodar Rao came to the U.S. in connection with the Lions Club conference or something. And that was when I got a first-hand narration of what had been happening. And of course, by that time, I had already checked with the Mayo Clinic, and we had accepted the fact that this was something in the realm of medicine, and they didn't have a positive cure. And they said, look, Umesh, all we can do would be try some experimentation on him. And you're in India, the neurosurgeons and the neurophysicians, Dr. Varma, there used to be a very famous neurosurgeon in Chennai, Dr. Ramurthy. And both of them have seen him, so we cannot add anything more. So when that was said, I said, you know, that door is closed. And as Gita said, we then start looking at other venues and how can we overcome what has happened to this little child. And the way the events started happening, I couldn't believe my eyes that, you know, the family was getting to accept it and, you know, they're mentally at peace, accepting gradually, you know, what was happening and not letting the negativity pervade. See, that was the most important
thing. That's a huge deal.
That is absolutely a huge deal. It is. And that is what triggered my interest in what was the force that triggered this. What brought about this change?
Change of perception and attitude.
Yes.
Many families would be wallowing in self-pity, losing faith in God under the circumstances.
Absolutely, yes. Blaming God, losing faith in God. And that people would add, you know, your relatives, your close friends would come and feel sorry with you. And that would make you feel even more miserable. So it was in a kind of a general scenario, you find something that is so sublime and so pure. It is a totally different experience, and I always wondered sitting there as to what is happening. But then I was not in a position at that point in time, because my career had just started, to come away, move to India. And so for me, for everything, a time has to come, and that happened to me in the end of 68 when I came to India. And I think within a couple of weeks or even a week, Swami was in Bangalore or in Whitefield. The first darshan that I had of Swami was in Bangalore at a devotee's house where they had used to have those bhajans.
My father-in-law met Swami first time at Dr. Padmanabhan's house. That's where he was introduced, because they were together in the Rotary Club as well as doctors in the field, and that's where he met Swami.
Yeah, Mrs. Vijayarangam was a dedicated bhajan singer in those days at Vrindavan. And at her house, Swami had visited, and my father took me there. So I was just sitting at the doorstep, you know, where Swami was to enter. And bhajans were going on, and this was going to be my first glimpse of Swami. And I still remember that whole episode very, very clearly. He got down from the car in the portico and walked in. And then when he stepped onto the threshold, I was sitting to his right. And I was looking at him with folded hands. And his eyes connected with me, with my eyes. And held on for about maybe 30 seconds or so. And father was saying something about my son. He has just come from the US back for good. And Swami just held that. And that, I think, was the change. That instant, if you want to call that 15 second or 30 seconds period. When I said, yes, what I see in those eyes, now I can believe all the transformation that has happened. Because there was something in that, you want to call it a combination of love, compassion, motherly look, or you have come back to my fold. Whatever it is, I don't know. But and that was the connect which changed the whole thing. And to use a very cliched statement, you know, that period when I came back from the US, I was really riding a very high horse in the US and a green card and all of that stuff. You know, had a very good job. So I thought, I was, you know, statement goes, he came, he saw, and instead of he conquered, I was conquered. So that is what happened right then. It was just that. I was totally conquered.
So 30-second transformation.
30-second transformation.
Very quick turnaround time.
Absolutely. Yes.
With Swami, I guess.
But you know, you don't know, time then stands still.
Yeah. When Swami looks into your eyes.
Yes, and that very deep, penetrating look.
Yeah. I think many of us can relate to that look.
Yes.
So this was 1968.
The end of 68, yes.
And then 1970, you ended up marrying Gita.
Gita, yes. But between, see, 69 was also a very momentous year for me and for the whole family. Because Vijay Sai was still very much alive, and I got to live with him, play with him, and bring him on to Vrindavan for darshans and so on. And that was the period when Swami used to visit our house. We haven't even kept
track of how many times he's visited our homes.
Where your home is?
In Bangalore. In Ulsur Road. It was an old bungalow which we had rented. And Swami used to, I'm sure he was coming there much earlier than 68. But after I went there, I had that experience of his coming in so often.
We used to live in Jai Mahal, and Ushaka and Narendra Mama were staying in Ulsur, where my father-in-law had his private practice. as well. So it was a very huge bungalow.
That was the incident that happened in 69, before we got married, this was. 69, when I came, Swami had been after my father apparently during this 63 up to 68 period of saying, you're still living in a rented house, that's not good for you, you got to get yourself and build a house. And it so happened at that time my father had operated upon the, I think the wife or the mother of the chairman of City Improvement Trust Board. You know, there are a lot of sites in Bangalore. And so he just asked my father, do you have a site, the chairman? And said, no, I don't have a site. And what is this, doctor? Here, I'm giving you a site in Jai Mahal. He didn't even know what it was, where it was. This is just after Swami had started bugging him, you know, about getting a place to build a house. And so then again, Swami was after him to get this site and build the house. And that's how the house in Jai Mahal got started in 1969. And 69, Swami came and did the Grah Pravesham for that house.
Is that where you still live?
And yes. We used to live there, but we still have our office.
We have that
there.
As our office now, and Swami insisted that my husband build his own house too.
And so that was when we had the Grah Pravesham for the first house when he came in 1969.
I see.
He asked me, when are you building your house? I said, Swami, I haven't even thought.
My dad will barely build his.
So, but anyway, he just laughed and passed on.
But, you know, being related, I was present there during the Grah Pravesh, and, you know, the master plan was already in place in Swami's mind, I guess. But after that, I left for Ahmedabad because my father was transferred there. And when we were returning from Bombay, he kept goading my in-laws saying, when is your son getting married? When is your son getting married? And he had received a couple of proposals from Bombay, and Swami said, she's coming from Bombay. And I had already caught the train from Bombay. So we didn't know he was meaning me because we were too closely related. But he selected the bride and asked my in-laws to send for my father and said, I will perform the wedding. And he was away in Gujarat in 1970 around May. And he told the Gujarat and Kutch Maharani there saying, no, I have to perform Dr. Sundar Rao's son's wedding. So I'm leaving. So every time, even now, when Didi meets me during darshan, she says, you are the cause why Swami didn't stay on for longer with us. It's because of your marriage that he had to come away so early. And he performed a wedding. He selected the date. He selected the bridegroom. And he said, I'll take care of the marriage. And during those days, we didn't have the Seva Dals. And, you know, it just used to be bhajans around the tree in Vrindavan.
Sairam Shet.
By then, my father-in-law was a quite well-known figure there in Vrindavan. So it's Dr. Sundar Rao's son's wedding, so let's all go. And everybody was there, you know, as our guests. And he performed our wedding inside the old bungalow, the old Thrai. I mean, it wasn't called Thrai. Mohan Palace, I think, is what it was called. That's where he performed the marriage. And that was the first marriage in the family which Swami performed. And some of our extended relatives were not very sure about the discipline which Swami expects from all of us. So we had to keep training them to speak in very low voice. And generally, there's this teasing of the bride and the bridegroom. And Swami, you know, didn't put up with any of that. So he came out of his room and he said, what is all this noise? And I was standing right there. But then looking at me like thousands of mothers love, he just shouted on me and says, take my pada namaskar. So the banging was for the general public. So I mean, these are little things which, you know, looking at me, and I was so scared that people were annoying Swami, but this was his reaction. And every little detail he took care of during a wedding, I mean, just can't imagine, right from putting a napkin in the holder for people to wipe their hands. I mean, that kind of love.
The other part of it, the omnipresence, was also so beautifully shown to us by Swami during our wedding time. When I came back to India in 69 and 70, we got married by that time. I knew a lot about the experiences of my father, my uncle Damodar Rao, Professor Narendra, and so on. And I think typically in those days, Swami used to give a gift of a Navaratna or some very flashy type of rings, as we called it, flashy in those days, to devotees. And just before the wedding, I was telling my uncle Damodar Rao and to Narendra, see, I don't like all those flashy jewelry. I hope Swami doesn't give me one on my wedding day, which is, you know, hard for me at that time, having come back from the US and with very set styles and so on. And so during the wedding, typically Swami materialized the Mangal Sutra for her, and which we did. Then he looked at me, it smiled. Then he materialized the ring, and he looked again mischievously, and this is what you wanted. And so he gave me this ring, a plain silver heart with a gold bust of Swami in it. Mm. And that's it. There are no gems.
And it's not flashy by any yardstick.
No, not at all. The base is heart-shaped with Swami's bust.
And Swami's got his hand up, right hand up.
Yeah, Abhayastha pose. And that's what he gave and put it on my
fingers. I must say it's shining a lot. The metal has not tarnished.
No, it's about 47 years old. I've not taken it off my finger, possibly shifted it from this to this or whatever. But
when he had his surgery, that's the only thing he requested the doctor, that he should retain the ring which Swami had given him. Because normally they ask him to remove
all metal.
Yes, and I said, I have to have this one. Do what you want. Wrap it up with whatever kind of material but it has to be on. So, anyway, that was something that, you know, which was obvious that he must have listened into our conversation the previous day or the couple of days previous to that. But it was such a thing that it still stays in our memory as to his omnipresence. Now, one other aspect, how Swami, when a devotee gets totally surrenders himself and gets immersed in Swami's work and service, that sometimes you don't take care of your own needs, typical your responsibilities, needs and so on. And I mentioned to you that when he came for our Gruha Pravesham of my father's house, which again my father had delayed getting that built in 69, in 82, 83, he started getting after me, when are you building your house, and start virtually hounding me at that point. Did you get a site? Did you get a site? So in 84, when Treyi was being built at the same time, and after the inauguration of Treyi, simultaneously our house in Arti Nagar, which Swami again selected the site, did the drawings, went over it, relocated rooms and all of that. He came for the Gruha Pravesham of that house also, and that is where we live now. One incident in that Gruha Pravesham, which I'm kind of wanting to narrate in both the incident itself, but which had an immense learning for us as part of our learning for our counseling thing, is Swami's, you know, attitude of humility, absolute humility, was so touching in so many instances. And this was one case where he came, there was a whole, you know, typical Gruha Pravesham, lot of relatives, friends, guests and all. Swami comes in and then he comes, look around, and then he's got his, you know, typical look, wants to see the house. But then he says, oh, so everybody is here too crowded, I'll come another day. And then he says, let me go to the puja room. Then and so we take him to the puja room, which he himself had designed.
Which direction, may I ask?
Puja faces east.
The house faces north yet.
We had the puja room initially designed so that it was upstairs to also help me with the balavikas. We thought we'll have a separate staircase leading upstairs to the puja and the balavikas. But Swami said, don't have it there. And he specifically said, this is the spot where you should have your puja. And later on, much later, we have a neighbor who kind of reads ley lines, divines water, and A.K.A. Ramachandran. So he mentioned that there was a direct ley line, energy line, leading towards the puja where we had shifted.
So that was an interesting thing. But when Swami came into the room, he looked at it, and then, you know, typically Radha Krishna was his driver those days. So Radha Krishna was standing behind a little bit. And he turned around to Radha Krishna and said, give me the bag, and he brought a little. So he said, you know, for this occasion, I brought a very small gift for you.
Oh dear, that's so sweet.
So he comes in, he doesn't want anybody to hear, just the two of us. And he takes out the statue of Krishna and he says, this is a small token of, I think, for your Gruha Pravesham. The way, the mannerism, you know, in which he said that, gave it. It was, you know, when you look back and say, how have we become counselors? If you analyze all of those incidents, the learning that happened over a period of years.
You were being tutored.
We were being tutored on what body language means. What is humility? What is egolessness?
It's amazing the kind of love he showed on us, and the kind of love we had for Swami as well. And Swami visited the house, as I said. 2 days later is when the Karnataka State Conference happened at Lal Bagh. So he came to the Jai Mahal house as well. And 2 days later is when Swami developed that severe pain in the legs. And he was immobilized. And that's something which I would like to share with you all.
Please. This was in the year
1974, soon after Vijuna passed away. And Swami's leg pain, it started on the 19th. Of March 1974. He just complained of very acute knee pain. And on the 20th March, Swami's darshan was cancelled, which he's never done. And all the devotees started wondering what had happened. My father-in-law had access to Swami's room upstairs in Vrindavan.
And Swami was a 40-something-year-old yes. young person.
Very, very young. Mm. So when Swami was immobilized, I think the kind of love which was exchanged between divinity and the devotee, my father-in-law kept praying to Swami, saying, Swami, why don't you cure yourselves? And this was the 10th day after Vijay Sai had passed away. So at home we were doing the bhajans, but my father-in-law and Narendra Mama were with Swami inside. I think when somebody prays with such pure intent, Swami, his heart just melts. So for the sake of the devotee, it looked like, and for the sake of all the devotees who were praying so hard, he just sprinkled a little water on his leg and he just jerked it. And his right leg became all right. And then he looked directly at my father-in-law and he said, now you'd pick up that water and sprinkle it on my left leg. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened. And this has been recorded by Shakuntala Balu in her book, mm-hmm. Living Divinity. And he just did that. The essence of this particular incident, I would imagine, is this exchange of bhakti between devotee and Swami, and how Swami's heart melts when a devotee prays with pure intent, not for his sake, but for somebody else's sake. Selfless. And this happened on the 21st of March at Vrindavan.
What you say, of course, makes sense. But when Swami was hospitalized in 2010, I mean, millions of hearts prayed with the same intensity.
Yes.
He didn't respond to us.
I think when he takes a decision for certain things to change.
Because so there's no set pattern. There's no telling.
That is true.
There was not a heart that did not beat for him. Even people who didn't believe in Swami prayed
Absolutely.
For a miracle.
That's true. Maybe this had some connection with Vijay Sai. I'm not too sure because it was the 10th day. Maybe he had taken something.
And also maybe to divert your attention to a bigger issue.
Issue, absolutely.
That way sometimes, you know, pain is very relative.
Yes.
And when we see a bigger problem, all of a sudden you forget your own pain.
Absolutely.
So we don't know what was in the cosmic mind.
That's true. Mm. That's very true. But this was the experience of how did the family take the loss of Vijay Sai. And as you rightly said just now, I think when the bigger cause was the concern of the family at that point, when Narendra Mama and my father-in-law returned home to say that Swami is now able to walk, I think all of us just heaved a sigh of relief at that point. And then later on, of course, in detail, he explained what had actually happened. And this is exactly what happened, that he was an instrument in some way. Swami had made my father-in-law, who was the grandfather of Vijay Sai,
right.
take on that responsibility of sprinkling the water and getting that feeling of satisfaction.
I see.
That his prayer had been answered. And,
I see.
You know,
it was some sort of healing.
Healing, yes.
Okay.
So, as I said, hope was something which was kept alive in us till the end and even after the loss. I mean, the doctors had given only 6 months, whereas our journey with Swami, because of Vijay being there, and Swami kept Vijay alive.
Another 8 years or so.
Yes.
I see. Now, when you got married by Swami, did Swami ever give you any marital advice?
He gave me a lamp, a silver lamp, immediately after the marriage, in the marriage panda. And he said, you have to be like the lamp of the house and you have to take care of your father-in-law and mother-in-law like they were your two eyes.
I see.
And you have to take care of your husband like he were your very breath.
Hmm.
And I think there was a reason why he said that, because I continued living with my in-laws. We were one happy joint family till Swami asked my father-in-law to move to Puttaparthi. And of course, even then they would come back to the family house in Bangalore. But my husband met with a very serious cardiac condition. I think I'll let him explain that.
Yeah, continuing where what she had to say was, this happened very, very much later. This is like in 1998 that I had this problem with my heart, which was really a problem with my mitral valve, which was never diagnosed. And we had taken several trips. We had returned from a trip attending my daughter's graduation in the U.S. And we came back, we went to Europe and spent a little time there and then returned home. And just the two of us were there, and my son had gone to join my daughter, and then they were going to return a little later. But when we came back, as usual, we drove first to Parthi to tell Swami of our return. And I wasn't feeling too very good. Earlier to that, I had been detected with a slight leak in the valve, and even at the super specialty hospital here. And they had said, nothing to worry, you just have to maintain your blood pressure and so on. But that day when I came, I was feeling really very tired. And then I had also to give a wedding invitation card of my niece. to Swami because they wanted me to hand it over to Swami for being blessed. And Swami came out of his interview room. I was sitting right up in front in the veranda. And Swami took that, smiled, and then gave me namaskar. Then went back in. And then bhajan started, so he came back, was going towards the bhajan hall, and was almost about to be seated there. Then he came back again, looked at me, smiled, went inside, and then brought out a vibhuti packet and gave it to me. And that was it. And then I went back home. I was feeling extremely tired. Then it developed into more serious breathlessness. And what really happened was my valve was just beginning to give way. And then when we went to the doctor, he looked at me, and this was really something, you know, very, very traumatic, because go there and he says, Umesh, I'm going to tell you something. Don't get very upset. You can't go home. I want you to go straight to an emergency room. You've got to be put on oxygen. Mm-hmm. So what followed after that was I had to be admitted, and there's no chance to even talk to Swami or anything. I had to go for oxygen and so on. So I was admitted into Malya Hospital, which Swami had inaugurated, Mr. Adhikeshalu's, you know, in Bangalore, and was admitted there and was on treatment at that time for a day. And then immediately we wanted to send word to Swami that this has happened, what should we do? They're asking me to go through a surgery, and we had told them at that time that we will not undergo any surgery or give any consent until we get an okay from Swami as to what should be the course of action. Because we didn't know whether Swami wanted us to come back here. The Bangalore hospital was not functioning at that time. And what transpired then was my sister, Narendra, was no longer there. He had passed on, but my sister was still alive, and she was in Whitefield. And because Geeta had to be with me, and my son was away in the US with my daughter, Usha came over here, and she met with Swami. Early morning, Swami used to give darshan those days at about 7, I think, in the mornings. So he came out, and the first thing he did was go towards the lady's side, and Usha asked, and he said, no, he is serious, let him have his operation and done over there, I'll take care of it. Meanwhile, what had happened over there was the surgeon there, the duty surgeon, was very, very insistent that I should be having my surgery, and he was really, very upset that we were not signing the consent form.
Mm-hmm. At Malya Hospital.
At Malya Hospital.
We waited for Swami to give the permission.
We said, no, we can't sign this unless we get an okay from Swami. And she had to bear the brunt of it, because I was in the ICU or whatever, in the critical care unit, and he kept on blasting her. But, you know, this is where the miracle part of it comes
and
in.
And I think
Swami,
that again was a testing point for us, whether we had completely surrendered to Swami's, you know, will and guidance. So I said, till my sister-in-law returns with the information and guidance from Swami, I'm not willing to sign any paper. And because pulmonary edema had set in,
my lungs were starting to fill with water.
This particular doctor was actually an expert at bypass surgeries, and he wanted basically to try his hand at mitral valve replacement, which was, I think, a technique which was different. But at that point, we just held on to Swami, and that was a very good decision on our part, I must say, because one of the best surgeons who was well versed in mitral valve replacement, he had gone on a temporary leave at that point. So he rejoined duty by the time Swami sent word saying that we could have the surgery.
We got a message from Parthi that we could go ahead with this Dr. Jayaraj, literally the number one in India for valve surgery at that time. And he had come over from Vellore and has just joined Malya. It was automatically his case. And so that was what Swami...
Very good hands.
Yes. Very good hands. And that's why I'm sitting here in front of you today. Because this happened like almost 20 years ago, 19 years now since I've had. So matter of fact, after that, Swami did mention that, you know, in an interview that he said, you see, I've given him a second life. So
it was touch and go at that point.
But that was, you know, like she said, another thing that we had to go through, that whole experience. And it has its own learning for us, because I understood the other side of medicine, the flip side where we become patients and we understand what is a patient experience and how Swami put it to use later on for us in the counseling program. But going back, I'm going back to 69, there were several visits that Swami used to make to our house in 69.
I always wanted to know what that felt like.
Yes, because a couple of those things there, at that period of time, the 60s and the mid-70s, that I think was really a golden period for us all devotees, in the sense that Swami had just emerged out of his avatarhood and all his, everybody started getting to know the Sai avatar. But it had not come to the stage wherein after his 60th birthday in 85, you know, it started taking a different curve in terms of setting up large institutions and so on. And then there was a huge change in the people that came in over here. So that 60s to 70s was a kind of a golden, because it was selfish to some extent that we had more access to Swami. And Swami in that way was, you could never predict what he would do. And there were, I think, at least several times that he would drop in unexpected into our houses. Both at her parents' place in Chamrajpet in Bangalore, my father-in-law was at the bank here in Bangalore, and to our house in Alsur Road. Suddenly, you know, he would be in the house and there would be a knock on the door, and, you know, you see a car driving in. Knock on the door, and one time Swami came in, put his hand on my lips, and he said,
"Be quiet."
Yes. Be quiet. And then he walked straight into the kitchen.
And my mother and my mother-in-law, they were cousins, so they were oblivious that Swami was going to walk in. So they were busy just, you know, frying something, and then Swami is standing right behind them.
My God, what was that like? I would have collapsed if I was the housewife there doing my cooking.
So that's the kind of relationship and access.
That happened.
Was the house tidy, everything?
Oh, yes.
Well, tidy in the normal sense.
My God, I would be so nervous to have such a divine visitor come unannounced.
Anyway, Vijay Sai was very much there, and he would be in the living room in his chair, and his face would light up, you know, with a big smile, because he sensed Swami's coming in, and he would, you know, in his own way, his eyes would start shining, and but of course he couldn't say anything. He would be there listening to some bhajan on the radio. So, and Narendra was there or not there sometime, because he wouldn't have come back home. And Swami would have just dropped in like this. These were, you know, moments that you still cherish.
Did you all serve him food?
Oh, yeah. He would ask, when he says, "What have you made? Have you made any bondas or bhajis?" Because those were his favorite. You know, asking.
Or at least we assumed those were his favorites. So that's something which you can really, you know, prepare.
Make, and
very
so
fast.
He'd come back and sit, chat with the family for a little while, and then he would get back.
What was the typical conversation around?
Just asking about the family and nothing. The only time that he would really expound on anything was when he got the whole family together. That is the bigger, you know.
Then he would give us.
Give a discourse and talk about why things happened and all of. A lot of discourses like that he would give.
But the conversation would always revolve around, he would just say, "Okay, ask some question." Mm-hmm. And we always looked up to our elders to ask the right question, because we would want Swami to stay longer. Mm. So if you keep asking questions, then he would continue to keep answering them, and he would stay longer with us. So it was something which we cherish a lot.
And there were several such, you know, times he used to come and go. And the other thing that Gita was referring to was, you know, after 68, was it that Anandpur College was inaugurated 8 years before? After that, Swami had in his mind that he wanted to have a women's college in Bangalore. I mean, just thought. And he would mention this to my father, and then, of course, Colonel Jogara was on the scene at that time, and Padmanabhan and a couple of other elders. So somebody, I think it was Colonel Jogara, said, right opposite Dr. Sundar Rao's, where he lives in Nandidurg Road, there is a big bungalow, about 6 acres plot, and it's right in the middle of town. Swami, that would probably be a good place to have a women's college. And very difficult to get 6 acres and one patch in Bangalore nowadays. So Swami said, "Okay, let's go and see it." So I was along with my father driving the car, and we came to see the place. It was just about evening, you know. And then suddenly Swami, we got down in front of this bungalow there, and they started going in and to get the gate open. And Swami suddenly told them, "No, you people, you all go and see that place. I'll be waiting for you here in Sundar Rao's house." So this house was across the street from us, on the opposite side, on Alsur Road, which in those days was very quiet road. So he got down there, but he didn't want the car to come inside the house. He got down there, then he took my hand and he held my hand. He said, "I've never crossed a road in Bangalore."
I can't believe that.
Let me cross. He holds my hand. Here is the avatar, God, divinity, and he's holding your hand and making this conversation. And we cross the road, he's holding onto my hand, and we walk all the way across into our house. Can you, just even imagine that such things happen?
All these opportunities were created for our bliss.
Absolutely. And I was very conscious that Swami was aware of every thought of ours. And he was present everywhere, because as a child of 13, and that's the kind of connect you have, because he knew everything, and he would just come out and tell you what was going on in your mind or what you were thinking about. And that made us very aware that we shouldn't have even one single negative thought in our mind. And once it so happened that a friend of mine, her mother ended up giving me egg omelette on bread, and I ate it, not knowing that it was a Thursday. And we're traveling by train. This was offered on the train. So when we reached home, my entire family singing bhajans. And normally we would have bhajans on Thursday evenings. And I'm so heartbroken saying, my goodness, how did I eat egg on a Thursday? Felt so guilty. And the next day we went to Vrindavan because Swami was there. And during those days we had just one single line starting from Swami's gate right up to the other gate. Mm-hmm. And maybe a second line. That's all the number of devotees, you know, who would be there in the evenings. And then as Swami walked by, I just stood up. And on my right was my mother, left my aunt. And they're amazed, why is this girl standing up? And Swami, then the moment you get up, he comes walking towards you. So he came towards me. And I said, yes, what is it? And I said, Swami, without my knowledge, I ate egg yesterday. And I'm really sorry about that. I mean, to that extent, you know, we had the freedom to tell Swami. And then Swami looks at me directly into the eyes and he says, what you did without your knowledge, right? So there's nothing wrong with it. Don't commit a mistake, knowing fully well that you're committing a mistake. Mm-hmm. That was his advice. And he said, take namaskar. During those days, he would just walk from inside the gate with the basket in his hand. He would carry the basket himself.
Mm-hmm.
And distribute vibhuti to everybody. And he just gave me a fistful of vibhuti.
See, those are huge learning lessons which have stayed with us. Because, you know, when we took up this counseling thing, something which is very important is not to be judgmental as a counselor. You know, you don't judge people. And for us, that was already ingrained into us by Swami's unconditional love. Swami's love was never tied up with any kind of a condition. This was just whatever might be your drawbacks, your faults or anything, Swami looked at that person with unconditional love. He might look at him maybe on his past karmas or whatever it is he has come to Swami. We don't know that. That is a connect between that individual and Swami. But the love that he would shower on that person, well, I've seen that happen in the world, and sometimes we wonder, my God, having been in the business field, you know, this person and all his background, how could Swami be, you know...
Or politicians, for that matter.
Or politics, yes, yeah, exactly. How is it? But then, now when you stop to think about it, you know, it dawned on me that it's basically when you say you're truly non-judgmental, which only with divinity it is possible. Humanly it is not possible to erase that little streak of having a little doubt of judgment.
In the context of the patients, I guess it is like we receive a number of patients from West Bengal who have the staple as fish. So telling them to give up non-vegetarian food would not be our responsibility, or in order to be judgmental that they are eating some fish, because this is one of the things that we're talking about as far as counseling is concerned.
That concern, you know, Swami was always, I could never understand, you know, he would make these pieces, but at the same time, his vision was so broad and he knew what was the reality and what was happening, and he accepted humanity as it was or as it is.
Well, if he started being picky, he would not have too many people around. Given the state of the Kali Yuga,
yes,
we would all be dismissed.
Yeah.
But Swami did say publicly that if you call yourself my devotee, there are some things you cannot indulge in,
yes,
lifestyle choices. Those include alcohol, drugs or smoking, any kind of substance abuse, and meat eating.
Yes,
right, that's true.
He has said that. Matter of fact, he said that, I think, in
1990
birthday. He,
yes,
was very, very emphatic.
65th,
yes,
birthday, very,
yes,
emphatic.
Very,
yeah,
emphatic, he said that. So, and that is true. But again, you know, Swami is like a multifaceted diamond. So, you have to be looking at him in the context of what happens. And again, when you look at Dharma and you follow this Dharma, if you said you have listened to it, again he tempers that by saying, use your intellect and your discrimination. See, this is more of a bigger issue at the hospital amongst the doctors, because what do you tell patients who are, all that they can get is just their fish?
Seafood.
Because, yeah, seafood, because
and the maximum number of patients come from two states in East India where the staple is fish.
Absolutely.
Or in, from Kerala. Hmm. That's the other thing. Now, the other part is we have a lot of Muslim patients coming. And there are a lot of people whose profession is being a butcher. What do you tell them? I mean, what can we tell them without hurting their sentiments?
And it's not that they are bad people.
And they are so grateful to Swami. So we get into, we've had this discussion with our deity, everybody in the hospital, you know, we say, what can we tell them? So sometimes we feel helpless.
How about telling them to switch to Sai protein, ragi, lentils, legumes?
Would you honestly tell that to a fisherman who doesn't have any access to this, who's living in a shack by the seaside, and to him that has been his life? He's living in a little fisherman's shanties there in that side.
That would be very impractical.
And he would be a man practicing all the five values in his life. Spiritually evolved. You know, but
that's his livelihood. That's what he has access to.
Yes. So I think that's where we need to. I think we understand Swami's love for everybody, universal, whether they are...
Yes, Swami has made the statements publicly, but I think it is for the overall general good. I think that's a very good statement, you know, because we need to become vegetarians as much as possible.
But we cannot judge others for being non-vegetarian.
Yeah, exactly.
However, we would not encourage that.
Yeah.
Right. So the 69 period was really something. It was the period between 69 and 70 when Swami started shifting. We shifted over to the Jaimal house and Swami started coming over there. When the organizational roots were beginning, Swami was wanting to make the foundations very firm. See, I think 68 Dharmakshetra was inaugurated and all the movement about the Seva organization movements that started. Swami
the first Seva
organizations and
was
so
conferences
similar,
held.
Yes.
Anantapur was inaugurated.
And in Vrindavan, Swami had just then started the Vrindavan College, which started off as only as a pre-university college, just the 2 years, affiliated to the pre-university board in Bangalore. It was not yet become a full-fledged this thing. And that was when there was also a big tussle, because what do the students do after the 2 years? They would have to join Bangalore University, because to go on for the BSc or BA whatever. Otherwise they would have to, or start a university, which is what eventually happened. But that was the time when all of this was being resolved, that there were people like Dr. Gokak, my father, Dr. Padmanabhan, and several of these people, a few other people, Ndiyamappa, chairman of the electricity board. This was a core team that Swami used very, very effectively to start forming the foundations for this whole thing in Karnataka. See, a lot of these people, you know, you don't see the roots of a tree. You see the branches, the flowers, but this is what Swami was going about in that period, the 60s and the early 70s.
And I believe your mother was also quite active.
Yeah, and Balvikas were starting.
The first
then.
Mahila Vipag in Bangalore, the Karnataka, was
Matter
started
fact,
by Swami.
Narendra's appointment, he came to our house and he was teaching in Madras in Jain College in 1970. When Swami came to our house after the wedding, and Professor Gokak was there and all of these people were there. Then he told Narendra, and his father was standing there, "I want you to join my college. Will you join my college?"
This was on the 23rd of May, 1970.
2 days or 3 days after we got married.
Yeah, he'd come home after he performed a marriage.
Just like that. And without batting an eyelid, "Swami, yes, Swami, Swami wants me. Yes, you come and join us here, principal." And he said, and you know, Narendra's surrender at that stage, so total that without batting an eyelid, he handed in his resignation to the college, even without getting an appointment letter.
Mm-hmm. So he quit his job in Chennai. Madras.
And he started base to Bangalore.
Immediately reported.
Which was extremely good for Vijay Sai, because he could have Swami's constant presence and connect on a regular basis here.
And he came at that time, I think the PU board thing was there, and one Professor Kulkarni was in charge at that time. But then they shifted, and I think Narendra and then Gokak and a few others were very actively involved with setting up of, there was a lot of agitation in Bangalore at that time regarding this changeover. Some of the people in Whitefield did not want this to go away from them. I mean, the local residents, not the Sai devotees. So all of that, Narendra and they were all involved in setting up this. And then the Seva Dal got formed over there.
And Swami would visit nearby villages as well. And Sigihalli and a couple of other villages. And the next day send an engineer with Narendra Mama, saying, "Go check in at the temples and make sure that it is all in good condition, or we'll renovate that." So the social service also has started side by side around that period.
Good people like Mr. Krishnan, who was then in charge of this thing, our Sundaresh's father, Dr. Chander, he was one of the people who was involved in that.
The general hospital was started.
As a matter of fact, the general hospital in a small way was already starting to function then.
Invite visiting doctors.
There were a doctor, I don't know if you know of a Dr. Hegde, who was the gynecologist. Mm-hmm. He used to come in his three-wheeler, an auto rickshaw. He used to drive that. And that was the period Swami wanted some stethoscopes to be ordered, and my father went and showed him this. And that's that iconic picture,
Black and white picture of Swami wearing
he's actually
the
checking the heartbeat.
The other side is my father.
Oh, he's checking your dad's heartbeat.
Yes. So he's checking me. So he said, Sundara, you wait, let me check your... So that's my father on the other side, who's taken the stethoscope to him. Mm. So Swami, at that point, I think he started laying the foundation for all of these things, on which we, whether it was the seva there, whether it was the medical, or whether it was the education. A certain pattern started being formed and set, which just has been followed. There's been not been a major change in that. It's been, from there, it has been growth.
And you know Sri Gopal Rao, who was a permanent resident here?
Yes.
He shared something with us as a family. He said he would always wonder why Swami had these little talks with Dr. Sundar Rao in the safe room. There used to be a safe room in the old Thrai. And he also used to think, why is only Dr. Sundar Rao being taken in the car by Swami? So one day, I believe, he just got into Swami's car, closed the door shut, even before Swami could get into the car. And then Swami came and sat in the car. And, you know, Swami pretended that he didn't know Gopal Rao Ji was sitting at the back. So they drove a few furlongs away from Vrindavan. And suddenly Swami turns around and he says, Gopal Rao, what are you doing in this car? And then Gopal Rao says, Swami, if you ask me right now, I'm going to jump out of the car if you deny me this pleasure of taking a ride with you. And Swami said, no, come with me. Pichiwada, come with me. So this was the kind of love he had for these old devotees, as well as the kind of love devotees had for him. Like little children they became, you know. Well, when Sundar Rao can go, why not I? And when he shared that with us, with so much of
love,
and honestly, it was like something.
Yeah, talking of those rides, was one of the rides then, I think, before the this Hanuman statue here on the hill.
Yes. Hillview Stadium.
Mm. Yes. That one was, I think, inaugurated or built around the 60th birthday, I think, 85, right? So the thing behind it was one of these drives. My father was going along with him, and my father is a big Hanuman bhakt. From his childhood, because there is a temple near our house in Jaimahal in Nandidurg Road. It's a very, very ancient, it was not really a temple. It was really a carving of Hanuman on a big rock on a hill. And it used to be called as Bande Hanuman. Bande in Kannada means a rock. And my father and his classmate, they used to go and sit there during their school days. And from that time, he was always a Hanuman. But so when Swami was taking my father and going for a round and looking at the idea of building a stadium and what to do with that was coming up. He said, Sundara, what do you think we should have on this hill? I'm thinking in terms of different idols and God. And so my father right away said, Swami, we must have a Hanuman Swami. And Hanuman in full this thing, with carrying the
Sanjeevani.
And see, my father said that as a devotee and a doctor. Swami said, yes, we'll do that. And that's how that thing got started. But then when it came back to the engineers, L&T, you know the story behind that? The L&T engineer said, anything like that, extended out like that, the Sanjeevani Hill, we need to put a column below that, otherwise it's not going to...
It can't be a freestanding structure.
And then Swami sat with them and showed them how exactly to design it, that it could be done as a cantilever design. Mm. But the whole origin of that story was on simple drive, and my father said, Swami, build a nice grand statue, Swami. And of course, Jogara was there at that time. Said, Swami, whatever you tell me, I will do it. And he was also very thrilled that it was going to be a Hanuman statue. And that's how the Hanuman statue came from one of these little...
And this makes us feel that Swami Sankalpa is already there. Sometimes he likes a devotee to feel that he's been instrumental in...
So he speaks the words to them.
Yeah,
yes,
absolutely.
Yes,
yeah.
And then it...
And many people say that the words that came out of their mouth in Bhagwan's presence were not premeditated.
Absolutely.
You know where they came from. So obviously he puts them inside your mouth.
Yeah. See, he never went on this drive thinking about it. He just said, I want to do something to this. What should we do?
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of Swami coming to your house so many times, just walking in, dropping by unannounced, and, you know, standing behind the ladies cooking, and the kind of informal familiarity that you had, During those moments, were you awake or aware of the fact that you were dealing with the divine incarnation, or were there moments where the Maya enveloped and you kind of forgot who he was?
Tune into Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Dear listeners, Sai Ram. On 31st October 2015, at the age of 86, Mrs. Joyce Darlene Barker merged into the cosmic light at the Lionsgate Hospital, North Vancouver, Canada, after a brief illness. During her short stay in the hospital, she experienced the presence of her Lord, Bhagwan Baba, in the form of Vibhuti manifesting upon her person and in the hands of her dearest friend, a fellow Sai devotee. Mrs. Joyce Darlene Barker celebrated her last Christmas in Prashanthi Nilayam on December 25th, 2014 and was blessed to speak to the thousands of pilgrims in the Divine Presence in the Sai Kulanth Hall. A week later, on January 1st, 2015, she was a studio guest on Radio Sai live show Morning Glory. With her eyes closed, her palms open, she spoke from the heart during this interview. Her words were charged with deep meaning and have a power to move our hearts forever and ever. Truly, that which is an absolute truth is valid for all times. Here now is that interview with the late Mrs. Joyce Darlene Barker of Vancouver, Canada, recorded in Prashanthi Nilayam on 1st January 2014 as part of our Thursday live show, Morning Glory. Mrs. Joyce Darlene Barker is in conversation with Radio Sai's Karuna Munshi. Have a listen, please.
It is my pleasure to introduce all of you to my wonderful studio guest, a dear friend and a fellow Canadian, Mrs. Joyce Darlene Barker, also known as Mrs. Moeller, and she is the celebrated author of Sai books for children and adults. Now, by way of introduction, I can tell you the nearly 86-year young Joyce was born on March the 14th, 1929, and she has, during her professional years, worked as a children's librarian for about 26 years and also became a minister of a small church, a non-denominational church, one of a kind. And there, she experienced many miracles, including about 20 years later in her life, she realized that her teacher and her minister, Mrs. Elsie Hager, had been to Prashanthi Nilayam twice and had always loved Baba. Now, Joyce has been coming to Prashanthi Nilayam since 1988, and she has written many books for children as well as for adults about Baba, and they include the following titles: Where Did Grandma Go?, To India with Grandma, Bringing Baba Home, Grandma Joyce's Baba Tales, and she's brought out a CD of Grandma Joyce books. Joyce has also written books for adults, which include The Touch of Baba, Unforgettable Baba, With Love Baba, I Will Do Baba, I Will Change Baba, and the soon-to-be-published, I believe, Finding My Way Home to God. So, Sai Ram, Joyce, and a very warm welcome to Radio Sai.
Sai Ram, thank you.
It's wonderful to have you here. Now, I want to begin by asking you, where did your Christianity begin?
Well, it must have begun in another life, because I really don't know where it came from. My folks were not religious. And one time when I was quite young, six, my mother started going to a little tiny church in a little tiny town, and she signed us up, my sister and myself, for a summer Bible study, a school, summer Bible school. That was the first time I heard the name Jesus.
And I fell in love with him immediately. I fell in love with his compassion, with his dedication to everyone else but himself, to his wonderful words of wisdom, to his miracles that just blew me away. And I believed in miracles immediately. You and I and Einstein all have the same birthday.
Yes, indeed.
And Einstein said, there are two ways to live your life. One is as if everything is a miracle. The other, as though nothing is a miracle. And, of course, I believe everything is a miracle. And as a child, I just soaked up every word of Jesus like a sponge. I tried to live my life like Jesus. I tried to follow what he suggested. I prayed to him. He was my best friend. He was the one that I told all my troubles to, and he was the one that I listened to in prayer. And after this initial meeting of Jesus, I found that about 8 years of age, I was sitting with two little girls out in the country on a brick wall with our legs dangling over and a sunset in front of us. And I remember now giving them a sermon about...
Sermon on the wall.
about God, creation of a sunset.
Oh, wow.
And then I
remember... The minister in you was brewing.
It was there, but I didn't know it. And the other thing I remember was the first funeral I did. And that was for a chipmunk. And the chipmunk was put into a little box, and we buried it, and I did a service for it. And you know, this was just right down my alley. I had no idea what I was doing. But he was coming through. God was coming through all this time. And with all the troubles that kids have growing up, there was never a time when I didn't turn to Jesus to say, what should I do? If Jesus were here, what would I do? So I have a great deal to be thankful for that I was introduced to Jesus first. And so many years later, probably, I don't know, 60 years later maybe, was when I was introduced to the name Baba. It was through my teacher, Mrs. Elsie Hager, who was also the minister of this little church that I attended as the children were growing up. And she was a remarkable woman. You know, she taught us as well outside of church. She taught us how to live, not just as a minister, but just generally how to live. And I didn't know until much later that what she was teaching us was Baba. She had come, she said, to Baba twice. And 20 years later, after having classes with her, all of a sudden, I realize this woman is a mine of diamonds because she was telling me something that I really wanted to know. Of course, those first 20 years, I didn't have a clue who Baba was. And one of her suggested reading for class happened to be a book on Baba. And it was a long time before I got around to reading Sandweiss's book.
The Holy Man and the Psychiatrist, by Dr. Samuel Sandweiss.
And that was the first book. And as soon as I finished that book, I wanted to go see Baba.
And here you are today, I think 2.5 months short of your 86th birthday.
Yes.
You just celebrated Christmas in Prashanthi Nilayam. You gave a very inspiring and elevating talk to the entire congregation of devotees in the Kulwant Hall. Now, going back, if you look back, Joyce, what was the first Christmas you had in Prashanthi Nilayam like?
Oh, my goodness. It was wonderful. I had been used to, up to the age of 6, in dealing with presents only. You know, Christmas trees, presents. My father would go to great lengths to let us know that Santa Claus was on the roof with the reindeer. There were sounds, and there were footsteps, and there were jingles, and we came out, and there was footsteps on the rug, and it was all Christmas. That was Christmas. And it was wonderful, but Ah, then I discovered what Christmas was really about. It put the Christ into Christmas when I came to Prashanti. It gave me an idea of what the real Christmas was like, the first Christmas. It was so magical. It was so beautiful. It was like, words fail me. All I can say is that it was pure, like a flute. It was pure like artesian well water. It was beautiful like the jasmine flower and the smell of the jasmine flower. It was full of love and fellowship and caring for people. We all shared that basic belief in Sri Sathya Sai Baba. He was who we wanted to be with, we wanted to be around, we wanted to listen to, I wanted to watch every movement of his. He said, "Don't lose sight of me." In the hall, I had very good eyesight. I guess I still do, especially long distance. I would watch him until he was just an orange speck across Sai Kowand Hall. Never took my eyes off of him as long as I could, because I followed what he said. Everything he said, I took to heart. Everything I heard, I tried to put into practice. He has been a wonderful part of my spiritual growth. And it was interesting because moving from Jesus to Baba was not a step up, it was a move over. His teachings were no different than Jesus. They were not in conflict with anything I had learned. In fact, they just made them stronger, more powerful, more understandable than anything I had had before.
Oh, that's so eloquent and so heartfelt. Now, as a former minister of a church, Joyce, I'd like to ask you, what is your favorite Bible quote to explain the relationship of the growth of a Christian into a Baba devotee?
Well, I ask before coming to give me a verse, and I open the Bible, and okay. This is what I open to. It's 1 Corinthians 13, but it's not the usual ones that are quoted. When I was a child, I spake as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man or a woman, I put away childish things. I started in as a small child giving sermons to a chipmunk. And eventually I grew up and out of being attached to any church and being able to look towards something greater and which covered the whole waterfront. The second verse after that is, "For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as I am known." To me, that is exactly what happened. Slowly, all of us have to grow through our pettiness, our jealousies, our angers, our fears, our griefs, everything that keeps us separate from God. And when that happens, then we do not see through a glass darkly. We see face to face with God.
Wow, very well said. Now, Joyce, I believe you were very fortunate to have interviews with Baba, and you had an interview where you sought clarity from him about the relationship between his teachings and that of Jesus.
Yes, I'll never forget that.
Would you care to share it with our listeners?
Yes, I will. Baba asked us if we had any spiritual questions. And I hit my forehead with my palm of my hand because I had meant to bring those questions. And, of course, Baba saw to it I did not. So, therefore, what I could ask him was, Jesus, I love you both. I cannot reconcile the two. And his profound and simple answer was, don't try. So I have never tried to figure out the whys. Why did I become a Christian? Why was the only one in the family who really was interested in this sort of thing? Why was it that my great-grandmother gave me her great, huge Bible amidst the relatives being very unhappy about it? And she said, she's the only one that read it. And that was that. Great-grandma was probably an influence that I wasn't even aware of as a child. So we learn, we grow, we come through all these painful experiences, and we have to do that. Nobody is immune to what we have to go through. However, Baba talks about like a morphine shot, that he gives us this morphine shot of love, of Baba, to help us through all this stuff that we have to learn before we can see him face to face.
Very well said. So he advised you not to try to reconcile.
No, and I haven't.
And Jesus still holds a very special place in your heart.
Very definitely. In my kitchen, there's a picture of both of them. In the bedroom, there's both of them. In my heart, there's both of them. I do believe that Jesus was sent by his father, Baba. I've never been hung up on dogma of any church. Whatever church I was close to is the one I went to. And they were all Christian churches. They all had different particular things that they pushed, so to speak, to the congregations. But I never seemed to be concerned about that. Whatever I needed to learn, I learned. Whatever I needed to read, the book was there. Whatever I needed to say when someone was in trouble, I said. But it was not me. It has always been God behind the whole universe who speaks.
Joyce, it's so interesting to hear how broad-minded you are, how open you are to loving God in every which way possible. And it's the same sentiment very refreshingly seems to echo from the Vatican this time around, because the current Pope, Pope Francis, has been talking about this open-mindedness, has been talking about accepting and letting people be who they are without trying to convert. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's fantastic. I haven't really read that much about it, but I do remember hearing about it. And my thoughts are that it's bound to be. It's going to happen no matter what. And that one day, it won't be in my lifetime, I don't believe, because of my age, but one day there really will be only one religion, the religion of love. It can't be anything else. God has willed it so, and it will be.
And to that thought of only one religion, the religion of love, we all say amen.
Yes.
Wonderful having you on the show, Joyce Darlene Barker. Thank you for sharing your thoughts, your experiences and insights with Morning Glory listeners.
Thank you for having me.
Sairam.
Sairam.
Sairam, you just heard a conversation with late Mrs. Joyce Darlene Barker of Vancouver, Canada, recorded in Prashant Sinilayam on 1st January 2014 as part of her Thursday live show Morning Glory. In conversation with her was Radio Sai's Karuna Munshi. Please do send us your feedback and suggestions and comments on this and on any other Radio Sai program by writing to listener@radiosai.org. Thank you, and Sai Ram from Prashanthi Nilayam.
Jai Sai Ni Sarveshuni. చిత్రవతి తీరము పరమ పవనము వేద వేదాంతుడైన సాయి మహాత్ముని రంగిన భక్తుల బాడలు మాపవ కలిసి ఉండే ప్రతి సాయేశ్వరి మహేశ్వరుని పరాత్మరుని కలిసి ఉండే ప్రతి సాయేశ్వరి ధూపది పాములని వెలిగించి స్వామికి పంచభక్షణని వేద్యములని చేసి పాలించే దోచి సాయినాథుని శ్రీవాసుని పరమేశ్వరుని సత్య సాయిని పాలించే దోచి సాయినాథుని శ్రీవాసుని పరమేశ్వరుని భక్తవత్సలని పాదమిగతియని భజనలు చేసి భక్తి శ్రద్ధలతో మంగళములు చేసి వారములని విడి మంగళములు పడి జయ హరతి మంగళహారతి ముత్యాల హారతి జగదీశ్వరి జగదీశ్వరి జగదీశ్వరి.